Hey, everybody. Welcome to Whiskey, Wheels, and Wounds. I'm Sean, 9-year Air Force vet.
And I'm Steve, 22-year U.S. Army veteran.
We're going to start out the official first episode of Season 2 with our featured whiskey of the week.
The featured whiskey this week is Freedom Whiskey. The company is Have a Shot of Freedom Company, LLC. The distillery is Have a Shot of Freedom in Wilmington, Ohio. It's 90 proof, aged 10 months. The mash build is 75% corn, 21% rye, 4% barley. The MSRP is $50. Have a Shot of Whiskey Company is 100% veteran owned and operated. Founded by Zach Hollingsworth, U.S. Marine Corps deceased, and Scott Brown, U.S. Air Force. The company works in partnership with an undisclosed distillery located in Spring Valley, California. And have a shot of whiskey. It's good on the rocks. It's good neat. It's good when anything you put in it. So Have a Shot of Whiskey is our featured whiskey of this episode.
All right. So that's the whiskey. And then this week's topic, one of your soldiers and you had a conversation with and thought it'd be a good idea to touch on the term hero as it relates to military service, veteran status, people that think they are heroes, people that need to be classified as heroes, people that don't think that other people are heroes, and just the whole gamut of what that term means in our community.
Yeah. And, you know, I think with social media and with media in general that, you know, the term hero gets so watered down.
Oh yeah.
That term has been, stripped to its bare bones. Especially through COVID, everybody was a hero through COVID. And, so basically the conversation between me and this soldier, Callahan, shout out to him, faithful listener. He likes to critique after our episode.
He is, if nothing but consistent with feedback.
That's right. He was wounded in Iraq in 2007. Took a dishka to the bicep. And he, you know, when people call him a hero, he don't receive that well.
Right.
I'm not a hero, you know, and as he would say, I'm not a hero. You know, I stood up in the hatch of my Bradley for 2 seconds and somebody shot me, you know. As I tried to explain to him, you not thinking you're a hero, heroes don't think they're heroes.
Right.
You know what I mean? Then, you know, he proceeds to say, well, what about the less stellar soldiers that we had that, you know, back in garrison, they were not, you know, your A guys,
your hard chargers.
I mean? Yeah. And, you know, what about them? Are they heroes for just being in Iraq? And, you know, I would say the 2010 me, that's the last year I deployed, may not have thought that. The 2024 version of myself has a great appreciation for everyone who served.
So the dictionary defines the word hero as a person who is admired or idealized for courage, outstanding achievements, or notable qualities.
Right.
So that's the base definition for it. I think that there is some credence to Callahan's position.
Right.
And there is credence to your position. I think that the term hero, by not applying the term hero to everyone, I agree with Callahan. But I agree with you in the fact that if you were in Iraq or Afghanistan or Desert Storm, Vietnam, whatever you were in, well, let me rephrase that. If you raised your right hand and joined the military for the right reasons, you had something in you that was a heroic quality.
Mm-hmm.
And while you were in, if you weren't a complete and total, you know, Article 15 chaptered out, somebody that just could not conform, you know what I mean? Like they didn't have a good quality to be in at all. Okay, that didn't apply. But even if you were just a supply clerk during a time of peace and you were, and you know, you served with distinction, you have heroic qualities about you. That doesn't necessarily make you a hero, but it makes you hero adjacent. You know what I mean? And so when you go to Iraq, you're already highlighting some of your heroic qualities, because most people, there were ways to get out of going.
Yeah.
And so there were a lot of times that if someone got out of going, people called them cowards. You know, they couldn't, well, hold on. So to prove my point on this one, there's a website I went to. It's the Mighty Oaks Foundation.
Uh-huh.
They have a little blurb.
They're associated with Mission 22, but go ahead.
They have a little blurb here that it highlights what I was just saying about people that went, you know, embraced those heroic qualities, and people that figured out ways to get out of going didn't. A hero is someone who has recognized a need, counted the potential cost, and decided to act in spite of what might happen to them personally, because there are people or a cause that justify that action. Heroism is unusual not because others can't do what the hero has done. It is unusual because others won't do what the hero has done.
Right. Now, I will say there's levels to heroism.
It's like an ogre. There's onions.
Yeah,
there's layers.
Many layers. I would contest that there's layers and there's levels. And we'll say that the Congressional Medal of Honor is the top.
Oh yeah.
Of that level structure.
Correct.
Something has to be said in this country. 0.45% of this nation's population serve in the United States military.
Yes.
There's some heroism there.
Yes.
Especially in the last 20 years when you knew. When I joined in 1993, there was no war going on.
Right. And when I joined in 97, I mean, the stuff in Kosovo was going on, but that wasn't like a full-blown.
Right. So I joined after Desert Storm, you know, and we won't rehash that, but I joined after Desert Storm with no, and for 10 years, I trained every day in case of war.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was a break glass in case of war type thing. And then when 2003 came, for the next 10 years, I was at war. I was either in country or I was home training for the next time I was in country. To say the PAC clerk, the POL person, those jobs does not help win a war is ridiculous.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I was a mechanic on the flight line.
Yeah. To say those jobs there are not vital to the warfighter, right, is ridiculous. You know what I mean? And, you know, in 2007, make sure I'm, 2007, we were on Rustamaya for 15 months.
Ooh.
Right? Day one, being on Rustamaya, we got a rocket attack. The last day I left, we got a rocket attack. And every day between day one and the last day, we were rocketed or mortared, right?
And it was called, for a reason.
It was called Rocket Rustamaya, right? And they would shoot rockets out of the back of trucks, just riding down the MSR and boof, shoot mortars at us through propane tanks, over the walls. You know what I mean? They tried to get us. Those mortars, those rockets, they don't give a shit whose chew they land on. They don't give a shit whose head they land on.
Correct.
Everybody on that FOB was in the same amount of peril every day.
Correct.
And everyone, you know, there was very few, if any, people that spent their whole time in the bunker, right? They made a choice every day to leave their chew and walk however long the distance was to get to their office space or the motor pool or whatever it is, in spite of those fucking rockets.
Correct.
You knew they were coming.
Yep.
You knew they were coming. That's fucking heroic.
Right.
That's fucking heroic. Another, you know, I say this again. I was in awe of the human condition, right? In 2005, the 2007, the 2009, when I went back to Iraq and we dealt with IEDs, you know, being a combat engineer like I was, you know, our job was to ride down MSRs and look for things that go boom and find them before they find us or find someone else. That was our job. You know, the heroism in that is when that truck gets blown up, right? And what amazes me about the human condition is that truck gets blown up, it goes black, the air goes out of the vehicle, you don't know if you're upside down or not. When that all dissipates, you check on your gunner, you check on your driver. I'm good, okay. You know, you get out, you do what you were trained to do, and then the next time, it's time to get back in a fucking truck and do that again. They do it without question.
Right.
That's some heroic shit.
Yes, it is.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
That's some heroic shit. And regardless of that soldier, private, specialist, sergeant, whatever, regardless of what kind of person he is, what kind of military member he is, to do that, that's, to me, in my definition, I'm not Webster, but to me, that's some heroic shit.
Right.
You know what I mean?
So I agree with you that it is 100% heroic. I think where that's why I think the where I agree with you that everyone that served over there has a heroic trait, heroic qualities. I think that, like what Callahan was getting hung up on, and this is why I agree with him. I served on the flight line in Afghanistan, mobile radar in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, mortars, all that stuff. But I was never in a position to do something truly heroic. So I could not, in good conscience, classify myself as a hero, because to me, a hero is Airman Pitzenbarger in Vietnam, won the Medal of Honor.
Right.
Desmond Doss, World War II, won the Medal of Honor. So the word hero, it has to have reverence again for those guys that are Medal of Honor winners. And if you call everybody who put the uniform on hero, it cheapens the term hero for them. So that's where I think that there should be the distinction between being a hero and having heroic qualities. Because sometimes, like you pointed out, we were talking earlier, there's guys that in garrison or even when you're just on a FOB or something, they display zero heroic qualities.
Right.
And then shit hits the fan and you're like, holy shit, where'd this cat come from?
Right.
So I think that everybody has the potential that serves because of the heroic qualities it takes to raise your right hand, write that check for your ass to the U.S. government, go where they tell you to go. And a lot of times guys like you and I and other guys, they volunteered to go. Like, hey, look, I know that I don't have to go this deployment, but you're fucking sending me. You know what I mean? Especially when you become a good NCO, you're not sending my guys and you're not sending me with them.
Right.
Like, that shit's just not going to happen. But that doesn't necessarily make you a hero. It just makes you, you have heroism in your blood, in your DNA, and there is the potential there for you to step up and be the hero that's needed for that particular day. You're there and ready. You know, it's like you tell the support members, it's not your fault that you didn't get deployed, but you were there and ready and willing to do it.
Right.
So that's where I think the difference between having heroic, most people should be labeled as having heroic qualities or displaying heroism, but not truly a hero unless they've done, like, now I know there's some guys that have done that could be classified as heroes that may not have the Medal of Honor, because there's a lot of guys that, you know, Silver Stars, yep. You know, those types of things that haven't quite got the Medal of Honor, or the government has deemed it not Medal of Honor worthy. But if you look at the description of their medal citation, you're like, motherfucker, why ain't he got a blue ribbon around his neck?
Right.
So that's where I can kind of see Callahan's point. That word has to be, and if we're going to use hero applied to everybody, I know if you say the word Medal of Honor, it's instantly like that, that's it.
And that's my thing, you know, the Medal of Honor is its own tier, you know what I mean? So it's its own, you know, and to receive, to be a recipient of the Medal of Honor, your gallantry, your extraordinary acts of heroism. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So
you know, it'll say that in your citation.
Right.
So, you know, gallantry under fire and extraordinary acts of heroism. Well, that right there says if you can have extraordinary acts of heroism,
you can have regular acts of heroism. So and actually I just thought of this as we were saying it. So then I think this is gonna sound kind of hokey, but if everybody that served in a war zone gets classified as a hero,
uh-huh.
Medal of Honor recipients are superheroes. You know what I mean? Like, there's your levels.
They're the closest thing to fucking Superman.
Yep.
We got.
I'm down with you. And in that scenario, I think by describing it in ways like that, if you understand, so the average layman doesn't understand that, but in our community, we should. And I think if we approach it from that perspective, that Medal of Honor is, like you said, the closest thing to Superman that we have on this earth, then it doesn't cheapen calling everyone else a hero.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You know, and the other, you know, the other thing is, you know, one of the tongue-in-cheek things is, you know, they would say, you know, there's a thin line between being a Medal of Honor recipient and being a recipient of an Article 15.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, no, a lot of you know, a lot of soldiers or a lot of service members, recipients of the Medal of Honor, they sometimes disobey orders and run into, you know, hellfire despite what, you know, what their leadership says.
Well, like if, you know, if you watch the movie Hacksaw Ridge about Desmond Doss,
right?
His command tried to chapter him out because he refused to pick up a gun.
Right.
And then, you know, and I don't know how all this plays into the actual story, but at the end of the movie, I think it was his captain, told him, I've never been more wrong about a person in my life.
Yeah.
But it took him doing something that qualified him for the Medal of Honor for the other guys in his unit and his captain and his NCO to understand this guy's not a piece of shit. He's not a coward.
Right.
Like, he is the truest form of the word hero, but you couldn't see it because he didn't want to pick up a gun. So there's where you're on that fine line between being chaptered out.
Right.
And winning the Medal of Honor. Like, yeah. Like, the dichotomy there is crazy.
Yeah. And then, you know, if you look, we were talking about the movie Outpost and Ty Carter.
Yeah.
You know, recipient of the Medal of Honor in Afghanistan, and him and Clint Robichaud. I had the honor of meeting Clint on two different occasions when North Canton became a Purple Heart city. I met him there, and I also met him at the Patriot Ball up in Canton. So, you know, like I said before, you know, at the Patriot Ball we go to every November, you know, they always have, I think the Patriot Project is up in Canton. A chiropractor, Dr. Novelli, started the Patriot Project. And basically he has, I want to say, 10 or 12 Medal of Honor recipients on his board. The board of the Patriot Project. And every year at the ball, a Medal of Honor recipient will be a guest speaker. And, you know, to talk to them, they're the first ones to tell you, you know, I did my job. I didn't do, you know, someone had to pull a guy out of fire or whatever. Someone had to do it. I hope my battle buddy would have did it for me, you know, or my battle buddy would have did it for me, or, you know, to push back on something you said, you know, I think if something would have happened on the flight line, you know what I mean? Like, just because, like, those who leave the wire have more opportunities to do something extra heroic.
Correct.
You know what I mean? You have more opportunities. You know, there's more chances of somebody shooting at you outside the wire than there is inside the wire, besides the mortar and rocket attacks. You know, so I get that. But, you know, veterans are considered heroes in several reasons, right? For several reasons. You know, sacrifice. Veterans have made significant sacrifice in order to serve their country. They have put their lives on the line, endured physical, emotional trauma, and spent years away from their family. That's us. That's our sacrifice that we talk about on this podcast, of the sacrifices we made. And, you know,
it's not the ultimate sacrifice.
No, it's not the ultimate
sacrifice. But it is still a sacrifice.
And I will tell you this. You know, I went and talked to my good buddy, Nicholas Smith. Oh, by the way, shameless plug. Laser State of Mind is his company who made these hats. He didn't make the hats, of course, but he made the leather patches. And did that for us, and we're pleased to rock these things.
Yeah, they're slick.
Yeah, we're pleased to rock these. But I went up to the James this past week, and you know, Smitty made E7 in the Army within 9 years, and then he was diagnosed with cancer, and. Since 2014, he's been battling cancer and, you know, two lung replacements. I mean, he's been, you know, when I walked in the room Monday, he pulled up his sweatshirt and showed me his sacrifice. You know what I mean? Is that motherfucker a hero to me? 100%. You know, he gave his everything for this country, right? Now, did a war take him out of the fight? No, right? But, you know, what makes him a hero to me is his attitude about his current situation. You know what I mean? He's upbeat, motherfucker coaches wrestling in Urbana. And, you know, I had to give him shit about that. You know, I'm like, goddamn, man. Like, if you're in the state you're in and you're still doing all these things, you have your own company, you have, you know, he also has a fitting and tooling company that, you know, he has his hands in fucking everything. You know, I don't have an excuse. I don't have an excuse to be lazy. You know what I mean? Like, and again, you know, our motto around here is find a reason, not an excuse. And that motherfucker finds a reason every day.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And so
it makes us feel like ass when we climb off of our bikes after riding 7, 8, 9, right. 10 hours, and we're like, oh,
fuck, yeah. I hurt. And I'm like, fuck, I can't complain now. Yeah. You know, I was saying that, you know, earlier, like, you know, these double amputees that they're running around on their blades, running, you know, and I'm like, God damn, man, now I don't have an excuse not to cut the grass. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? But yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's so sacrifice is part of it. Service to me is part of it.
Yep.
Like, you know, it goes back to that less than 0.5%, less than 0.5% of this nation's population serves in the military or is currently serving in the military. And I mean, you know, bravery, you know, now you may pick a job that will keep you out of harm's way. But as soon as you step off a plane in, you know, Baghdad or Kabul, you know what I mean? Like, you're in harm's way. So, you know, there's some bravery. Now, granted, there's less of a chance. You know, there's 100% chance you will not get hit by a roadside bomb if you don't drive down a road. 100%. You know what I mean? But, you know,
but every swinging dick that goes to bed at night has the exact same chance to never wake up because you caught a mortar in the middle of the night.
You caught a mortar, you know what I mean? So something has to be said for that.
Yeah. And I think part of that too is also the VA, because they classify different ailments for disabilities based on whether it's combat related or not combat related. So like if you've got issues, but you never left the wire and engaged the enemy in direct combat, you don't qualify for certain things. Even if you were, you know, say a mortar came in and, you know, they deem that as non-combat related because it was indirect fire. So, well,
I mean, it's the VA, so I get
it. Right. But I think that the way that that's classified also drives that divide between out of the wire and in the wire. Because, you know, Sarge sent us something a couple weeks ago about some program through Ohio for veterans, I think it was with PTSD, but it's only combat-related PTSD.
Right.
So when I said that mine wasn't diagnosed that way, he was like, what the fuck are you talking about? And it's because I never left the wire, so the VA classifies it as non-combat-related. So I don't qualify for certain things, and I'm labeled slightly different. Now, to me, we've had long conversations about what I deem combat, which is funny because by a lot of definitions, I'm labeled a combat veteran, but by VA definitions, my injuries are not combat related. Right. So I don't know. It's a goofy topic, but that lends credence to that fact that, you know, A prime example. A guy on an aircraft carrier out in the ocean, nowhere even remotely close to Iraq or Afghanistan, is still labeled as a combat veteran because they were there serving in support of the theater of operations.
Right.
But so he's a Navy guy. He's with a group of Marines who all were ground pounders in the dirt. They're going to look down on him because, were you off safe on a boat doing your thing? Should they? No. But can you understand it? Yes.
Well, I mean, so, Brian Bowe, Ohio Cigar Mafia, Wolfie, he hit me up on the phone and he said, hey man, I didn't know there was this, stigma about female veterans and how many female veterans, commit suicide every year. I'm like, oh yeah, it's a huge stigma. I'm like, it's a stigma, it's a stigma in the community. It's a stigma, I mean, there's, again, many layers to that stigma, and I said, yeah. But in our community, people feel that way. I've said it before. I 100% think females need to be in the military. They have a place. Around me wasn't that place for me, right? Because of the things I saw, of the small snapshots of times I spent around females in the military.
It's like any group. There are some of them that give them an excellent name, and there are some of them that do not.
Right. And
I saw it, being in the Air Force, it's a little bit different, cause we're all soft, sitting in highfalutin hotels and stuff, but, doing maintenance like I did, we would have females that would come in and would use their femaleness to get out of doing things. And then we would have other females that would go above and beyond to prove their worth and that they should be there.
Right.
Because they would sit there and they would go, that bitch has given all of us a bad name. So I'm going to step up my game to show that bitch don't represent me.
Right.
So,
and I've told the story before of being going from in 07, I think, going from Rustamaya to Camp Victory. And Camp Victory had a bus route.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It was a large place.
Yeah, it's called the Victory Base Complex for a reason. There's multiple installations.
Right. We would park our, usually when we're going from Rustamaya to Victory, we were taking our vehicles in for services and they had, special mechanics over there that worked on our equipment. So we had to take them over there for specialty service. So that gives us, an hour, 45 minutes, whatever, to go kick it, right? And, you get on the bus and two female airmen walk by, and they had, earrings in and perfume. And you're like, I wonder if they know a war's going on outside. And we talked about this off camera, and that's how I have felt. Like, I wonder if they knew, because I don't think rockets are getting in here. You know what I mean?
They did.
I don't think mortars ain't getting in there for sure, but
before they put the the phalanx system up on the hills there on the VBC.
Yeah.
That cut down on a lot of them, but they were, there was, before those phalanx systems went up, there was quite a few coming in. Because when I went over as a civilian in 2006 to 2011, I was assigned either at the VBC or around the VBC.
Right.
So, yeah.
But I'll tell you, then, I felt then the same way I feel now. I think everybody has their place, and I think everybody's place needs to come together for the team to win.
Yes.
You know what I mean? I never talk shit about the dude that worked in our headquarters that did the trip tickets. I never talk shit about him. Why ain't you going outside the wire?
You might have given him shit because we give everybody shit.
Yeah, we give everybody shit.
That's the brotherhood.
We give everybody shit. But to me,
you didn't think less of him.
No, I didn't think less of him. Like, I did a podcast last Thursday. I did a podcast with my buddy Chris Showalter, Mutton Chop Mondays on YouTube. Go check him out. And
we'll put the link in the description.
We will put the link in the description. But, he was part of a platoon that they rotated. They rotated from on the road 1 month. And then the next month, they'd be on the roof pulling security. There was no part of me ever that ever wanted to stand on the roof for a guard shift. I would rather take my chances on the road all day, every day. And so I'm not going to talk shit about you for pulling guard up on the roof because I don't want to fucking do that. I don't want to talk shit about you for fucking get my pay straight or fucking feeding me or rendering aid to me or, all the things provide air defense. I'm not going to talk shit about none of them because, at some point I need all those. You know what I mean?
In 04, when I went to Bagram, the Army guys, because Bagram at that time was Army boss rules. The Air Force had Camp Cunningham, small little B hut thing right next to the flight line, right in the center of it. Kind of like the way Pope is with Fort, it's not Fort Bragg anymore. It's at Fort Victory now, right?
No, something else.
Oh, okay. But either way. But the Army guys, they'd see the Air Force uniform, and they're like, these motherfuckers. And then they'd be like, what are you here with? And I'm like, well, we're here with the A-10s. Oh, fuck. No way. Like, the Army guys instantly gave the Air Force guys that were there for the A-10s, like, you still weren't Army on their level, but you weren't a fucking, bougie fucking Air Force guy because you were there with the A-10s. Because the ground pounder has such a affection for what the A-10 does for them. So it was kind of nice to see they were kind of nice to see the change on the look of their face when they had an encounter with us, and they'd be like, fucking Air Force.
Yeah.
A-10s. All right.
Right.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So there's still that stigma that, I'm bougie Air Force, but to the guys that know what I was doing there, oh, motherfucker, you are 100% needed.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because if I'm not doing my job, then they don't have the equipment they need to do to keep those planes flying. And if those planes ain't up in the air, then when those guys want danger close, danger close, danger close, it ain't coming.
Yeah. It's, Fort Liberty.
Okay.
I mean, not Victory.
Got it.
Adjacent.
Yeah.
Liberty.
Which is funny because in the Victory base complex,
Liberty,
there was a Liberty base in there.
Adjacent. Yeah. So was Stryker and so was
Slayer.
A-10s were, they're awesome.
Yeah.
The brat out of Fort Leonard Wood, because they would fire on a range out in Missouri, and you'd hear it, and it's, it's the purest sound of freedom.
Yes.
That there is.
Yeah. Depleted uranium freedom seeds.
I mean, it's the purest, But, you know, it's, you know, like, Apache pilots, same, it's the same thing. Like, we would go in 05, we would go from, Bakuba or Bakuba, in just north of Baghdad to, Al-Samaniya, which is up north. It's about a 6-hour Humvee ride. So we had to refill our Humvees, refuel, I guess would be the proper term, not refill, but refuel, with gas cans, you know, 5-gallon, cans. So, and we would get, escorts by the Apaches and, you know, we had to, on a couple different occasions, use the Apaches, Bear 37 was a female pilot. And I'm like, man, you know, I need to run into her somewhere and buy her a beer. Cause she, you know what I mean? But yeah, like, I think, but what kind of warfighter would I be if I wasn't getting paid? What kind of warfighter would I be? Now, granted, you know, on large FOBs, Halliburton is fucking, or KBR, or one of those, you
know, core floor.
Right. Yep. I mean, you know, cooks ain't cooking and, you know.
So from 6 to 11, that's what I did. I worked for KBR and their operations maintenance support. And the way that whole concept came about was the Army didn't want to send soldiers over there to do the garrison job.
Right.
They wanted boots on the ground, especially when at one point at the surge, there was like 30,000 guys assigned to the Victory Base Complex.
Right.
And so their thought process was, it's cheaper to hire civilians to come over and contract work,
right,
instead of having soldiers fill that role. And then they can put soldiers in trucks out doing convoys, escorts, manning fobs, doing the, you know, the things out there that need to be done. And so, you know, a lot of times, you know, I'd have soldiers tell me I was a war profiteer or something like that. And I'm like, bro, if my guys aren't here doing carpentry work and fixing your air conditioner and doing all that, who's going to do it? Because if you're out behind, if you're out in the wire, how are you going to go out there for 12 hours, do your mission, and then come back and do your air conditioning job? You ain't going to want to fucking do that.
Yeah. And there's,
when I talk about that, I'm looking at it as the bottom rung worker,
yeah,
not the CEO corporate level, because that shit was crooked as fuck.
Right.
I've said before that whoever they got to sign that fucking contract for the LOGCAP 3 contract from the Pentagon,
right,
that captain had his palms greased like a motherfucker, because that is the most lopsided, redonkulous contract I'd ever seen in my life. Did I benefit from it? Absolutely, both while I was enlisted and when I was over there as a civilian.
Right.
But it's still fucked up.
Yeah. I mean, that goes without, I mean, we can get into the ins and outs of government contracts in supporting wars, and that's a whole show in itself.
Yeah, that is 100% a criminal syndicate. Like, the mafia ain't got shit on government contracting.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, a former vice president is on the board of Halliburton.
And what's
written on the board of Halliburton while he was in office giving Halliburton government contracts.
Well, so what's really funny is that people don't realize the amount of things that are under the Halliburton banner. Like, when I worked on the flight line, everything we had was Snap-on. And you know, Snap-on's stupid fucking expensive.
Right.
Once I got into government contracting and I started doing some digging, Halliburton has like 60% stake in Snap-on. I mean, come on. Everybody got a little piece of something.
That's not heroic.
Nope.
So
that's a grift. That's a grift.
we can agree on that.
Yeah. 100%.
That ain't heroic. But yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, we talked about sacrifice. We talked about service, you know, and it has to, you know, when you sign on the dotted line and raise your hand, you're, you know, the old term, you know, you give your soul to God, but your ass belongs to me.
Yep.
Type, you know, Full Metal Jacket shit. And I used to tell my guys all the time, I don't give a fuck why you join the Army.
Right.
Doesn't matter. I joined for college money. I don't care. I joined the, I don't care. Go to war or go to jail. I don't care. Because we found ourselves in Iraq together.
Yep.
Right? And I used to, you know, I would stand in formation and say, I don't give a fuck why you're here, but we're here together. So for the next however many days we're here, college money don't matter. Fucking, you know.
I don't care what your motivations are. I just need you to be shit hot.
That's it. And, yeah, you now we get back to the two, you want to do online classes by all means, you know what I mean? But when we get in those vehicles, it's a singular mindset and, you know,
it's game time.
It's yeah. And, it is time to be some steely eyed killers. And,
I think a good way to kind of highlight your point there is that every branch has its core values.
Right.
You know, so, you know, in the Air Force, it was integrity first, service before self, and excellence in all we do. If you can live up to your particular branch's core values, odds are you're going to be heroic.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like if you, and I'm not saying, I was the NCO that if you didn't follow the little rules when it didn't matter, you wouldn't follow the big rules when it did.
Right.
So I was that guy. So I was a bit of a hard ass. But if you lived up to those core values, if given the opportunity to be a hero, more than likely you would have done it because right. You embodied the core values. And while it's kind of, you know, PC or, you know, the company line or whatever, those core values truly do have meaning. And if you lived up to them, then that gave you a roadmap to how to be a hero.
Right.
I guess is the way I wanted to put that. Because I know the Army's one spells out like leadership or something.
Yeah. Yes. LDRship.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, I never made a conscious effort to, you know, live by that.
But you never made a conscious effort to go against it either, right?
Correct.
It was just, it was who you were just fit into those guidelines.
Well, it's like a, you know, like we've said before, I knew guys in my career, it's almost like they woke up every morning, they opened their nightstand, they pulled out an NCOER, and they looked at the blocks and be like, all right, today I'm gonna write this bullet for myself today. Yeah. I was never like that.
Those were the guys that looked great on paper but couldn't execute to save their lives.
Right. And I was never like that. You know, I was always you know, I wanted to be in the military. I loved the military. I embodied what I thought being in the military was. So
like for the four of us in the tug group,
right.
We're all like-minded NCOs.
Right.
We all four of us can attest that it was always mission first.
Yes.
And sometimes that was the detriment to our personal lives, sometimes the detriment to our professional lives. But we always put mission first because, again, that embodied that spirit, that core value of Army, Air Force, whatever, I joined to do a job. I'm going to be the best at the job that I do, and that's what's going to be my main focus, not everything else. And that was part of the problem I had in the Air Force is I was very old school in that mentality because that was considered old school for the Air Force. And I did not embrace the whole, what I call the whole touchy-feely person concept.
Right.
And so it was a detriment to my career for a while because I didn't look good on paper. But yet when September 11th happened and they needed some stuff done, questionable safety protocols, but it needed to get done right away because, you know, we were, you know, in a heightened security threat. Who did they call? They called the guy who would do things regardless of whether it was safe or not because the mission dictated it needed to get done.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, I guess, you know, I trained my guys for 10 years. You know, for the most part, I was a leader from, you know, 96 to 2003 before,
Iraq,
before war kicked off, you know, and I trained, you know, my biggest, what's the word? Criticism that people had of me is, I train people too hard. Like, and let me tell you, the way I train my squads, my platoons prior to 9/11 did not change after 9/11. The only thing that really changed after 9/11 is we didn't run as much. And it would drive some of my lieutenants crazy. Like, but Sergeant Vickers, we have to run. I'm like, sir, I've been deployed 3 times already, and I haven't accumulated 2 mile running in Iraq. You know, now
you just need to sprint from cover to cover.
You know, like you know, so we did what I called battle drill PT. You know, we did a lot of flak vest stuff. We did a lot of carrying each other's body weights. Carrying litters, carrying, you know, things of that nature, jumping over walls, you know, scaling walls and things of that nature.
So guys were confident in their body. They knew what their body could do when shit hit the fan.
Everybody in my platoon could carry me off the battlefield. You know how I know that? Because in PT, everybody carried me during PT. That's how I know that. They're like, he's great, you fucking fat ass. Burp, burp. I'm like, listen, I got to make sure you can carry me off the fucking battlefield. You know what I mean? So
if I can carry you, you have to carry me.
Yeah. And granted, I was the largest one in the platoon.
Shocker.
I am a giant. It goes without saying. But no, it's, and, you know, again, and we talked about this in the past, you know, they didn't understand the method of the madness. And, you know, and it's not that I sat at home and ha, 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 you know, I didn't do none of that shit.
You didn't Mr. Burns that shit?
No, it was, you know, being deployed and, you know, seeing, you know, in 05, we went into houses and, the people that didn't let us in houses, we had to go over walls. And, you know, I'm like, ooh, we might need to work on this, you know, things of that nature. And I'm like, well, if we're training for war, and when we get to war, we're not doing push-ups, we're not doing sit-ups, we're not doing a 2 mile run, then what the hell? You know, granted, that's still the Army standards, so we're still going to do that. And, you know, my platoons, you know, still had one of the highest PT scores in the companies I was in. However, we're going to build those muscles that we need to use in war as well, you know? And so, yeah, I mean...
Well, they, one of the things they tell you all the time is you need to train the way you're going to fight.
Yeah.
And I think PT is one of those scenarios where that gets lost.
PT is one of those.
I know I'm saying that looking like a fucking scoop of mashed potatoes on this chair, but I've also been out for 18 years. So yeah. Leave me be.
PT is the ultimate measuring stick for some commands.
Yes.
PT is the only measuring stick for some commands. You know what I mean? And it doesn't matter how many DUIs you got, how many people you beat up in a bar. If you got a 300 PT score, you're fucking shit hot. You know what I mean? And I never subscribed to that thinking. Maybe if I did, I would have been in better shape when I was in the military. Maybe, you know, but to me, you know, I'd rather walk 12 miles any day than run 4. I was a pack mule. I knew my place.
I'm built for comfort, not for speed.
I knew my place. You know, I was in different schools where, you know, the small gazelle guys, they'd be like, oh, come on. You know, I distinctly remember being in ANOC and, you know, those little runner motherfuckers, you know, be like, how can you lead your troops from the back? You know what I mean? And then when we go to pick up something heavy, hey, come over. You know what I mean? Like, we all have our things we're good at.
Again, everybody's got a place.
Yeah, we all have our things we're good at. You know what I mean? And, you know, my thing was, we always did company runs. We never did company push-ups. You know what I mean? Like, what? Let's just do an hour and a half of push-ups right now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or just do an hour and a half of military presses. You know, I mean, goddamn. But I think to kind of wrap this up, I think, and maybe in my older age, I have a different clarity now. I don't think my service to this country and someone else's service who didn't go to Iraq 4 times is different. I mean, it is different, but I don't think the time served to me, the significance is the same to me.
Right. So you don't think that your service is better and no. You don't think someone's service is less.
Right.
Even though they were different, they're still the same.
Right.
Right. So, and that's how, like we talked earlier, like you were talking about with Callahan, he doesn't view himself as a hero.
Right.
But that's a heroic quality.
Right.
So someone on the other side of the fence who feels that his service doesn't measure up to, you know, my peers that I ride with all the time, I understand that it's same, same, but different. But as a man and as a veteran, when you compare yourself to your peers, they may not look down on you, but you know you're not on the same level. It may only be a step below, but you guys don't look down on me, but I look up at you. Does that make sense?
I mean, yeah, doesn't, I understand it.
Right.
You know what I mean? I understand.
You think it's stupid.
Yeah, I understand. I understand the approach. I understand how someone could feel, you know what I mean? And I've had lengthy conversations with Don Harper about it, you know? And I'm like, listen, man, I understand you join the army. You want to, you know, support, defend your country. And your ticket was never punched. And, you know.
And I think guys like me and Harper, we hear what you're saying. But part of us also says, but as a combat vet, as a veteran who was in direct combat with the enemy, you don't quite get our side of it. Because you're like, yeah, I did that, but who fucking cares? You did the same shit that I did as far as serving. But if you were on the opposite side of that fence, I think you would see things a little bit differently because of that. Look, nobody made a fucking movie about the guy that worked on the flight line and that was it.
Right.
Everybody makes the movie about the guy that engages the enemy. Right. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, like, in the overall grand scheme of things, you know, when the afterlife for whatever you believe in shows up, if there's a box for veteran, I'm good. You know what
right.
I mean?
Right.
But if there's a box for veteran, okay, you got that one. And then the next one is, like, you know, the hot, you know, like the true veteran. I'm probably not checking that box. You know what I mean? Like, but because I'm on this side of the fence, I have that viewpoint. You're on that side of the fence. Now, if the roles were reversed, I would think the same way you were. Like, bro, because I feel that way towards like my dad and Harper. You know what I mean? I don't understand. That's not the right way to put it. I don't think my dad and Harper should feel the way they do in regards to me, just like you don't think I should feel the way I do in regards to you and Duke right. and Sarge. But when right. you're not on that opposite end, it's hard to put yourself in that place.
And I totally get it because I deem my career a failure. It's on the same lines as what you're talking about.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, and there's no one, and people are like, oh, you did all this, brr, brr, brr. Like, get it. You're never going to change my mind.
We had that discussion last season.
Yeah. Never going to change my mind. My failure is mine. I own it. I can't change it. It is what it is. I really don't want to think differently of it. You know what I mean? I'm proud of a lot of things I did in the military. However,
proud of a lot of things we did. We're just disappointed that we didn't reach the goal that we originally set.
Right.
And we fell short of what that plan was.
But it's one of those things where I guess you don't know until you don't know. I knew, even though my mom didn't want me in the military, and we've talked about that before. And she made me promise I wouldn't be infantry.
Technically, you weren't.
And I wasn't. But I was the next.
You were infantry adjacent.
Adjacent, right? Very much so. So, when you enlist as a combat engineer and you're like, all right, what's that guy do? Minefields and, either putting them in or taking them out. Okay. Things of that. You're like, all right, that sounds cool. Let's, knowing in order for me to effectively do my job, I have to go to combat. It's in my name.
Well, and I've said before that if I could do everything over again, I would go Army and I would go combat medic.
Right. I mean, it's
because I know now that I'm pretty good at that medical stuff.
Right.
And I know now, looking back, like we were talking earlier, I have those heroic qualities that lends me to the thinking that I would have been a pretty good medic. What I've been, I don't know, but I think I would have been. And so I would wish I would have done that route. If I would have done that route, I probably would think more highly of my service.
And I will tell you this, heroism is relative to who witnesses it.
Yep.
There's a lot of people out there that think some of the things I did was heroic. And I would get back in the truck after doing said act, and I would look over at my driver and be like, at the picnic, don't tell my wife I did that dumb shit. You know what I mean?
Like standing in the middle of an intersection. Right.
You know what I mean? Don't tell my wife I did that dumb shit. But little did I know, she wanted me to, you know, she was all about the goddamn insurance money. But yeah.
That was her number one missed opportunity in your marriage was SGLI, right?
but yeah, I
think,
but it's again, it's the perception of who's.
Yeah. So I think we started this conversation, you being very steadfast in that everyone that served over there is a hero. And me being more nuanced with it. And then through the conversation, I think we both agree that everyone there is a hero, but there are levels to the hero.
And it's like a used car, right? How much do you pay for that used car? I paid $80,000 for that car. What? Or, you know, you get on Marketplace and you're like, look at this dumbass. They put, you know, an absurd amount of money for this item. Nobody's going to pay for that. And then 2 days later, it says sold next to it. It's what somebody's willing to pay for it is what it's worth. You know what I mean? If your family, if, you know, your loved ones, if they think you're a hero for the things that you did, you know what I mean? And they call you a hero. You know, it's like, thank you for your service on Memorial Day.
Yeah.
I'm
not going to yell at somebody for doing it, but I really wish they wouldn't.
Yeah. Like, and that was kind of, you know, that was kind of the thing that, you know, why do people clap for service members when they walk through the airport? Why, you know, because they want to show their appreciation for something either they've done and they know what you're about to endeavor, or they have no idea what you're about to endeavor and they're glad you're doing it and not them.
Yeah.
Yep. You know what I mean? And
to kind of cap my overall thought on the term hero, I am currently wearing my Hopewell Indians basketball shirt.
Right.
This is the Special Olympics team that my son plays for and that I coach. Having done this for a few years now, coaching the basketball and the softball with Special Olympics athletes, seeing what they endure to be contributing members of society and acceptance, and then what they go through on the basketball court to compete and things like that, I 100% will call Jason my hero because of what, you know, what he can do. What I was told would be his limitations when he was born versus the limitless reaches he's accomplished in the 25 and a half years he's been on this earth. So I guess that kind of proves your point that it's the value that's assigned.
And, you know, to me, if you become a nurse, EMS,
Fireman,
police officer, you know,
those public service type positions.
If you're a first responder, when you graduate first responder school, nursing school, any of those, right? You're giving the moniker, hero.
Mm-hmm.
And it's up to you to maintain that status.
I can see that.
You know what I mean? Now, if you know, I raise my hand, I know this ain't my right hand, but I raise my hand and, you know, I join the military and then I do a bunch of dishonorable shit. You know, one all shit negates every attaboy.
Yep.
Right? Which leads us to this week's episode.
Yes.
Oh, fuck that guy.
Fuck that guy. Okay, so this week's episode of that Fuck That Guy, I was kind of looking for some, and then you sent me a Stars and Stripes article or a military doc Yes,
Armed Stripes.
Yeah. Military Stripes article of a very unique individual. Right. Well, I wouldn't call him unique because here lately it's been rather rampant.
Yeah.
A 40-year retired, decorated Navy captain.
Yeah.
Who was shot dead by police in a child sex trafficking type sting, I guess.
Yeah, more pedophilia than trafficking.
But I mean, this cat thought he was talking to an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old girl.
Their mother.
Oh, okay.
Seven and 11.
Oh, okay.
7 and 11. He thought he was talking to the mother.
Right.
And he was coordinating sexy time with said children with the mother. And
in reality, it was the Seattle Police Department or.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And when he showed up and the door opened, he pulled his pistol and the police
unalived him
on the balcony.
Now, with that being said, innocent until proven guilty, all of that stuff. Okay, so there, we got that part out of the way. So you can't come at us and say we're crucifying the guy before he was found guilty. But this is like To Catch a Predator, bro. If you show up thinking you're going to do something, and just because they're not there doesn't mean you get away with not being a fuck that guy.
Right. I mean, yeah, thankfully you didn't touch a 7-year-old girl and 11-year-old girl.
Right.
Thankfully. But you had the intent.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
So this fuck that guy is with the intent of, I wanted to be a fucking dirtbag.
Right.
So fuck that guy. So which ties in to our episode of honorable service. So this dude, he still gets full military burial because he retired. Right.
Yep.
What honorable service. Come on.
Yes. You know what I mean? So his name was retired Navy Captain Bruce Menelay.
Yep.
He joined right after the fall of Saigon. Yep. He graduated medical school, served in Desert Storm, Iraq, Afghanistan, commanded the Navy hospital at Gitmo Bay in Cuba. Retired in 2016.
Yep.
Earned dozens of awards and commendations, including a Bronze Star and 2 Legions of Merit. And all the while, he was that kind of a dirtbag.
Yeah.
67-year-old white man when he arrived at the hotel room where he thought he was meeting 2 young girls, 7 and 11.
Come on, man.
What the fuck?
Come on, man.
Like, if ever there was a deserving douchebag
of
fuck that guy, like this guy's it.
Yeah.
Fuck now, that guy. Now to put the final bow on this fuck that guy.
Yeah.
In recent news, there's been this douchebag Navy captain.
Mm-hmm.
There's been the douchebag Navy lieutenant commander who was having sex with a child. And then on top of that, you've got that douchebag fucking lieutenant colonel out in California who put a camera in a dressing room of a store that is frequented by teen girls. And all they fucking did to that guy was transfer him because he was a fucking ROTC leader. So you 3 officers, which unfortunately there's a hell of a lot more officers getting popped for the stupid shit than there are enlisted guys.
Yeah.
So us enlisted guys get to stand on a little bit of a soapbox on this one and tell you cocksuckers with metal on your collars, police your people. Yeah. Because you guys got some fucked up shit going on and you're supposed to be above the standard because you're the leader. You're the officer. You're the commander. You're the motherfucker in charge. So police your people, because it's way more guys with metal on their collars fucking around with little kids and doing shit they shouldn't be doing. Now, I'm not saying there's not, because there's a large, there's a larger percentage of military members that are prior enlisted because of the way the command structure works. But if a dumbass private gets busted for something, he's a dumbass private. He's not a 40-year Navy captain. Like, again, there's levels to this shit.
Levels to it,
yep. And you are 100%, and I know that you are no longer with us, but I'm going to say it loud, and I'm going to say it proud. Fuck you. Fuck everybody that's like you, and you all deserve the fuck that guy.
And I think this might... This might invoke, I guess, another episode where we can look at, you know, what if he didn't pull the pistol? What would have happened to him?
Right.
You know, he would have been arrested that day, right? And then went on trial, and then they would have used all his text messages and messages that and correspondence they had to convict him.
Well, he was already on diversion because he got popped for prostitution, soliciting prostitution.
Right. But what I'm getting at is, so, you know, if he would have been arrested and he would have been convicted, he would have been put in prison. So, do we think different about him if he's in prison?
Nope. He's still a fuck that guy.
Yeah. But we might have to keep touching on that on a different episode.
Yeah. Well, if he would have been found guilty and sent to prison, he would have lost his ability to have a full military funeral. Right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But
so
how would the veteran community look at him?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, because that fucker out in California, that lieutenant colonel, the DA had a fucking solid kick-ass case.
Right.
They handed it over to the Army to process him, and the prosecutor and the judge advocate and all of that stuff in the Army decided, and we'll give him a slap on the wrist and reassign him, and that's all he gets. So, I mean, I honestly think that, especially in the United States, civilian courts should not hand these cocksuckers back over to the Army. I hammer their dicks to the walls, stop giving the Army and the Air Force and the Navy and the Marines, and I will acknowledge our younger brother, the Coasties. Stop giving them the opportunity to punish these guys, because they're not.
Right.
They're not. Now, if that had been a private, a specialist, a staff sergeant, whatever, the Army would have hung that poor bastard out to dry and used him as an example to God and everybody on why you should not do that. But because it was a lieutenant colonel, our bad, buddy. Here, why don't you just go over to this staff position and keep your head down for a little bit? But don't bother with not putting cameras back in little girls' dressing rooms, because, you know, that really doesn't matter.
I'm with you.
Oh, I'm fucking mad now.
So, yeah, so fuck that guy. And we'll have more next week. And, you know.
I think Andy has a button he needs to push.
He pushed it.
Oh, he did? Oh, okay. I was probably in the middle of my rant.
And he pushed it. But, yeah, I mean, you know. But that just hit me how that I think that'd be a good episode, how, you know, a caveat from, you know, we talk about heroism today. We talk about how the civilian sector views the military, you know, we're held in high esteem. We're held in that. And well, what happens when we tarnish that? Are we looked the same way? Do we devalue our service? Do we devalue how people look at the military when there's all these stories about what you just said, you know? And
I'll call them criminal veterans, because that encompasses lots of different things, not right. just pedos, but right. robbery, assault, all this. Yes. Criminal veterans.
Incarcerated veterans.
Yeah, there we go. Incarcerated veterans. And maybe even not incarcerated veterans, but veterans that did a plea deal or whatever. Right. But anyways, how does the public view them and their veteran status.
Right.
And then how do fellow veterans view them and their veteran status, I think is what you were trying to get me to understand when I was in the middle of my rant.
Yeah.
I got you.
So I think that's a good episode for next time.
Oh, yeah. Sounds good. Hi, Bear.
And Bear says it's closing time. So to put a bow on all this, you know, if you're a veteran, you know, and you don't perceive yourself a hero, chances are you are. And if your family perceive you as a hero, you know, don't beat them over the head about it.
Yep.
I mean,
just accept it. Quietly accept it.
Quietly accept it. And you know,
because I guarantee you, you probably feel that someone's a hero that doesn't think they are.
Yeah. And you know, and that means you're modest and you're humbled and all that stuff. And them are, you know,
heroic qualities.
Heroic qualities. I try to get it out there, but
display your heroism proudly.
Yeah. So, So thanks for watching. Make sure you hit the like button and subscribe and tell your friends. And
if you want to tell the people that you're not friends with just to torment them with us for an hour, maybe that works too.
Whatever it is.
Yep.
All right. We'll see you next time.